Welcome to the Alt Animation Podcast, the podcast that talks about the saltier side of the animation industry. I'm Josh Ryan.
I'm Robert Orndorff.
Well, I just got back from the Ottawa International Animation Festival not too long ago. It was my it was my first animation festival. I've been to a film festival before, but the crazy thing about it is it's only for animation.
It's only animation.
And like we've talked about
before, if you've got a live action film, get the heck out.
Exactly. Like we talked about before, you know, there's animation festivals all around the world, but really not so much in terms of North America, and Ottawa is one of the bigger ones. They had some really great guests. I mean, awesome dudes. Aaron Ogdenblick, Pendleton Ward, Dino Stamatopoulos, this awesome, I can't remember where he's from now. Estonia. Matty Kuhn is his name. Yeah. He had this awesome mustache.
What's his name?
Matty Kuhn. I can't pronounce it exactly. But he told me that what he uses to curl his mustache so perfectly was wax and chicken poop.
Okay.
So,
it's better than what Salvador Dali used, from what I hear.
Well, I didn't even know what he used.
I'm not going to say it on here.
Okay, right on. Well, just a couple things I wanted to talk about for anybody who hasn't been to the Ottawa Animation Festival or any animation festival in general. It is really cool because, like I said, you're just surrounded by thousands of people that are not only animation, they appreciate it, but they're in the business somehow or another. Or they're learning to be an animator or they've done it.
They're your peers.
Exactly.
If you're an animator or you're in the animation world.
And it just makes sitting in a theater watching an animation that much more, it's a great experience.
I imagine it's a different experience. The intelligence or the not just the way they watch it and the way they perceive it and digest it is different.
People pick up on things a lot quicker, absolutely. And, you know, things that should be funny or shouldn't be funny, people pick that up.
Is it... Yeah, I wish I could have been there. I would be afraid if I were an animator putting a film into that festival that it would be like... I'd have to be on my A++ game because it's like a magician showing his tricks to other magicians. It's like, oh, well, he clearly had his hand behind the hat on that one. Or like I don't know.
They have to be very honest with the story they want to tell and the way that they tell it because you can't cheat, People pick up on that. And that brings me to a point. Since it is the Alt Animation Podcast, I do like to talk about some of the saltier side of things, obviously. And it did seem to me like there were some that I felt that shouldn't have been in there, that were done, obviously with less artistic and technical knowledge, but because of who funded it, i.e. some kind of grant or, board of something, it got in. And I went to this, one of my favorite parts about the festival was it was a rejected one where you go and it was at night and you go and you drink and the guys who got their animations rejected, they get a free beer and they just play them, all in front of everybody, whoever wants
that
to go.
That would be my favorite part.
There was some in there that were by far way more amazing than the ones that even won sometimes.
Yeah.
And especially some of the ones that got in. And, like a film festival, there is a lot of experimental, artsy-fartsy kind of things, and I'm more inclined to enjoy a, Ren and Stimpy type cartoon, but absolutely, I loved,
I think there was a time when Ren and Stimpy would have been considered avant-garde.
Yeah, true. Well, okay.
Maybe not in the animation.
Take, for example, Don Hertzfeldt with his new stuff. Mm-hmm. It's very, dark humor, very funny, very, raunchy. Raunchy in a way, but it also, he tells a story, and it's very artistic and very, well
done. He satisfies multiple, desires or compulsions to,
absolutely. And there's a lot that are on the other side of the spectrum at the film festival where it's very, something like there's one where a guy just painted boxes and put them next to each other and kind of made them talk to each other. That was pretty cool. And there's one where a guy animated every day, it was like a second or 2 seconds a day, and just made a beautiful, awesome animation. And that one actually was one of the ones that won, but just a couple of highlights. I got to hang out with Dino Stamatopoulos, who does Moral Oral. Mm. Awesome guy. Really, really funny, really smart guy. He did a podcast on the Friends of Your Informant.
I hate you for talking to all these people. You're going to name off this list, and I'm just over here shaking my fist at him.
I got to see Pendleton Ward and Thurup Van Orman. Pendleton Ward, the guy who makes Adventure Time. Thurup, the guy who did the Marvelous Misadventures of Flapjack. I got to see them get drunk and fight each other in a nice way. They were buddies, but they're two really big bearded, burly guys. And it got pretty intense. It was really cool. You know, really surreal seeing these people in real life, let alone actually acting like human beings. Got to hang out with Aaron Augenblick and talk to him. Got to interview him, so you'll be hearing that on one of the next podcasts. Wendy Tilby and Amanda Forbes. Probably, I don't know, they're very inspirational to me because I first saw their stuff on the Animation Show DVD. And it blew me away. It was awesome. And to actually get to meet them and talk to them and see their new film and really hear their story is really good, too. And actually, we're hopefully going to get to interview them. I've talked to them online. We're going to get to hopefully Skype interview, but they're really busy at the moment, so we'll see what happens.
Okay.
Overall, though, it was a really crazy experience because, number one, there's a section of the Ottawa Animation Festival that is the Television Animation Conference. And you see the executives and the people that
the are in
charge, exactly, yeah, that are in charge of the money aspect of things. And on my end, I never get to see that, and to see all of them in a room together wearing their suits.
Didn't you going accidentally walk in?
I went to the wrong registration at the beginning, and I was absolutely out of place because it was at the Chateau Laurier Hotel, which looks like a castle.
Yeah.
You walk in, they have tea and, you know, and all kinds of fancy, like,
were there,
actual
were there
tea
any
kettles.
Butlers butlering at the moment?
The people that were working at the hotel definitely were,
yeah,
scuffling about and, you know, with wash towels on their arms and bow ties and things.
And you were, what, in,
I was in my
probably in your t-shirt, yeah.
Well, actually, no, I was wearing my Bart Simpson shirt from the early 90s.
That won't be the first time. In fact, I've been there before when everyone was in a suit and tie, including me.
Yeah.
And you were in the t-shirt.
That's one of the perks of being an animator.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You probably won't ever make as much money as those guys, but at least I get to wear my Bart Simpson shirt.
Yeah.
But if you guys get a chance, really check it out. I mean, there's been a lot of stuff nowadays talking about how festivals are kind of obsolete. If you read about the Thomas Beale Cipher, those guys, they did a whole post about how the internet's the way to go and don't even bother with festivals.
That's funny. I saw it for the first time in a festival.
I know, and that's that was the whole thing, is that they're talking about their festival experience is almost like an experience or an experiment.
Oh.
So, you know, I think there's still a lot of validity to it because I got to meet awesome people, got to talk to them, got to really, you know, feel like I was on par with some of these animators that have really made a successful career out of their lives. And, you know, it gives you a lot of hope, for sure. And just the fact that you get to meet your heroes is awesome. And talk to other people that are in the same boat as you, that may be from different parts of the world. You know, and I got to meet people from all over the world. I think I was the only person from Texas that I knew of there.
When you are online looking at something, you're looking at something that you are already inclined to see, or that a friend of yours who has similar tastes has suggested to you. When you're at a festival, you can bump into people, happenstance, serendipity plays a role in your interactions with people. And in other words, there's more chance. Things happen that you didn't expect or you didn't opt into from the get-go. I think, you know, that's still the best part of a festival is you got to see two people fight.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now,
I tried to make it more of a vacation, more of a trip, you know, and actually enjoy myself. But, I mean, really, there's nothing unenjoyable about watching cartoons and going to panels all day long, for sure. But I really tried to, you know, make it an experience of traveling.
What interviews did you get?
Aaron Augenblick,
okay.
A guy named Gary Schwartz, and really everyone was really busy, and my battery was dead a lot of times because I recorded everything that I could. And I'll hopefully release some of the more, I guess, exciting, relevant clips from some of the talks, like the Pendleton Ward talk and, you know, the Wendy Tilby one. And there was some really, really good ones. Matty Coont did one, too, but I didn't get to go to his, unfortunately. But they had some great features there. The one that I thought was the best was Chico and Rita, which is an awesome, awesome movie about Cuba back in the 60s and this piano player who wants to go to New York and play with all the big name, you know, Tito Puente and all those guys. Because there was a huge surge of that kind of music that they wanted in New York during this whole time when, you know, Hollywood was really getting into the swing of things and, you know, making a lot of money and things. And there was that whole ritzy culture. And you get to see these people coming from Cuba go there and how it changes their lives. And it's a really, really crazy story. It's, you know, it's a love story at the base of it. And, you know, it definitely makes you think about things, and it's really well done. really well animated. Some of the parts looked rotoscoped, maybe, but it was done so well that it seemed like it was animated. If it was rotoscoped, they did a great job. But one that really stood out was a short film called Many Go Round by Yoshihisa Nakanishi. I really butchered that.
Yeah, you and names, right.
What he did was... I'm horrible. He cut up boxes and circles and made like a stop-motion animation with these... I don't know how he did it. He had to use some kind of computer, I would imagine. But it absolutely took the audience...
paper?
Yeah, paper. All done on paper. Cardboard or something.
Origami or...
Exactly. A lot like origami, yes. Okay. They're cutouts. But he cuts it out of the same material, so the box that is the base of it is... He cuts the people out of that. So you not only get...
So there's like a positive and then a negative.
Exactly, yeah. There's
almost like face. Almost like a... Is it Escher who did like those?
Yeah,
the
a lot
fish
like that.
And the duck.
Or... Yeah, there's definitely a feel of that in there.
Okay.
But the audience was just totally captivated by these people just walking in circles and how much work it took. And it builds up and builds up to the point where all it took was one of the people to fall down and the whole audience gasped. Like, oh my gosh.
You're ruining this for me.
I don't even think there's a way for you to see it online yet.
Okay, well.
I'm talking about it because it was an experience that you wouldn't have gotten watching it by yourself. You know, like, I was watching it with a group of animators,
and that's the other part of being at a festival is, you know, getting to experience it with other people, the emotions being amplified. That's...
Absolutely.
Sorry, I've interrupted.
No. Overall, it's a weird, weird experience being with all those people and seeing the sides that you don't normally see. But in the end, I mean, it was... a total eye-opening, life-changing experience, and you know you can't say that about a whole lot of festivals. You know, trips vacations will do that to you, but man, I highly recommend anybody that gets a chance. Ottawa's a beautiful city, especially that time of year. You know, the festival was really well done, really well organized, and you know, a lot of really cool panels. And you know, aside like the hip hop in animation thing was awesome. It was really funny. They played a whole episode of the Boondocks, which was cool. And, you know, watching it with people that have never seen it before, especially, you know, these French, artsy, experimental animators enjoying the Boondocks, which is limited animation to a certain extent and just raunchy. It was really raunchy. Yeah, it was a really unique, interesting experience. That's about it of the Ottawa Animation Festival. So you guys will be hearing a lot about, you know, a lot more of what I recorded there and the interviews and things, and I'll probably talk about it quite a bit. But... you know, there's some parts about it that also were a little disillusioning. You know, you see the people that didn't seem like they deserved to be there that were, and the people that seemed like they did deserve to win or didn't won. There was some of that definitely going around.
Yeah.
And nothing's perfect.
I think that's that's just the nature of, like, you know, certain grants and state funding and...
Well, and any time you try to have some kind of competition when it comes to art, you're always going to have a certain level of, well, that's subjective, you know, it's what that guy likes and not what I like.
Yeah.
Also, I got to meet Jan Pinkova, the guy who directed Jerry's Game,
which
was awesome. He was a really cool guy. It was funny because a large amount of the shorts had to do with suicide.
Mm.
And he got to the point where at the end he said, okay, guys, like, after watching all these, you guys did a great job, but afterwards I'm going to take donations for the Canadian Suicide Fund. And everyone thought he was joking. And he's like, no, I'm really going to be out there taking donations because this is serious, you know?
Yeah.
So it was weird seeing Jan Pinkova out there. He had a big pink hat on.
Wow.
And he was taking donations, and he's got this British accent.
He's
a really funny guy.
He
a lot of unique characters there.
I got a lot of respect for him because his short was the first ever Pixar thing that I ever saw. I did not see Toy Story in theaters, but I did go to see Bug's Life, and before Bug's Life was Jerry's Game. So really, that's the first time I ever saw, you know, that Pixar style.
Well, a lot of people really appreciate that guy, and especially that movie in general, because it's so masterfully done. In fact, I think it was Mike Roush, one of the guys we interviewed back that works at Titmouse, he suggests to watch that movie, or watch that short, backwards and storyboard it out because you'll learn so much about filmmaking and technique and and why you line something up the right way in composition and actual storytelling. He said that's the best one to do it for, and he learned so much doing that. So I'm really planning on doing that.
Yeah, we should do that.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about Paul Hanley, who we're, or you interviewed, yeah. Robert. Unfortunately, uh-huh. I couldn't be there to help or
That's right.
help out with that, but you did a great job. Yeah. That was uh-huh. your first time flying solo. You did a great job.
Thank you. Yeah, Paul Hanley was one half of a creative group with a guy named Kieran Healy, who did a full-length feature animation, stop-motion animation, here in Austin, that took about 8 years, I think he said, to make. There were other people involved, but these guys were the, you know, the writers and you know, producers of it, and the animators. And I don't want to say too much. I think the interview handled a lot of it, but it. I feel like us being in Austin, we're a little bit lucky in that we get not just, you know, the animation aspect that is here in Austin, but it can still be a weird place, and you find these weird things, and these guys don't fit in with the normal animation crowd in Austin. They wouldn't be seen in the same circles. They just a couple yeah. of guys who went to UT Film School and decided let's do a feature.
It seems like the reason behind it wasn't to make an animation, but they used animation because it was the only way to tell the story
right.
that they
yeah,
wanted
yeah,
to tell.
Yeah.
They're not animators first, they're filmmakers first and animators
yeah.
second. Which, I mean, in some parts you can tell, okay, that's not the most amazing animation I've ever seen.
Right.
But they use it well,
now,
and they use it to tell the story that they wanted to tell.
On the nature of and the principles of animation, but at the same time, what kind of squash and stretch do you get out of a G.I. Joe?
Yeah, and that wasn't the point of it. The point of it
no.
wasn't to make an awesome animated movie. It was to make a, you know, the movie that
film,
they wanted
yeah.
to tell. Yeah.
yeah. So, and, yeah, so, like I said, the interview will, I think, deal with most of it. But, you know, and I only spoke with one, but super, super cool guy. Lives out on, like, a little ranch or farm. He had a horse and
yeah.
some, yeah. I fed it a carrot and
awesome
yeah so definitely not what I expected but awesome. So
well, one thing I would recommend while listening to this interview, if you're listening at work or something and you're, you know, you have it in your headphones, just pull up some pictures of the sets, because that's one of the most impressive things to me is how big a scope this project
was.
And, you know, to kind of get a visual while you're listening, just pull up some pictures.
I didn't mention the name. Did I?
No, yeah.
The name of the feature was, it is Viva the Nam. And I'm almost certain he mentions it in the interview, but in case he didn't, you can actually pull the whole thing up in chapters on YouTube, and he wouldn't mind at all.
Well, all right. Well, let's listen to that interview, and we'll be back.
Okay, well, I am here with Paul Hanley. This is Robert, and we're talking to Paul, the guy who is one part of the group that made Viva the Nam, the feature-length animated Vietnam War movie.
Yeah.
If you want to say hi, Paul, or...
Hey.
Anything you want to say
Hello.
Specific about it before we get started, or...
It's on YouTube. Go check it out.
Yeah, I'm going to mention that as well.
Yeah.
YouTube, you can just type in Viva the Nam. It's in... I forget how many pieces, but, you know...
I can't remember either,
yeah.
but it's a feature-length film that we chopped up into segments because we thought that made more sense for a YouTube audience.
Yeah.
And because I think it should be watched as a whole, but we made it deliberately to work in episodic format, too, for the YouTube version. And also, like, the YouTube version has kind of like a exclusive different edit, too, so you get, like, fun stingers and stuff at the end and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess the first question I wanted to ask is sort of the, before I knew very much about it, just sort of my first reaction to it, you know, stop motion animation is pretty much a rare thing these days. When you see it, it's, I would say it's very quaint, you know, is sort of your initial reaction to it. It's very, very rare. And then feature length, stop motion animation is even rarer.
Yeah,
so,
it's an extreme rarity nowadays.
Yeah. What possessed you or inspired you to do this feature length movie?
Well, partially because we thought it up in 1999.
Okay.
And so it didn't seem quite as quaint then.
Okay.
That's part of it. Really, it was purely a case of the first time I ever got my hands on a video camera was 1995. And the first thing I did right away was I got toys and did stop motion stuff with them, and it was really shitty. But it was like, that's how I could make something that was big budget, was I could take like a toy of Ed 209 and RoboCop and have them fight. Or I did stuff like with like me and my friends, and I was living in Cincinnati at the time. We did these spoofs with Star Trek figures, and we did an epic one of like Star Wars figures called Viva Strikes Back, which we put a little bit of that online. And they're not very good nowadays, but that was us being kind of ambitious, and we could do something like high budget, and that was more interesting to me than doing something with like live actors, and yet it's still faster than conventional animation, because the stuff was ready-made. So I guess if I want to sound like a pretentious, you know, film type, I guess it's guerrilla filmmaking, and we're not caring about copyrights and that kind of stuff.
Okay. Well, and I want to give you the chance to I know Kieran was mm-hmm. another part of it. I don't want anyone to think that you were the only one doing it.
So if you
want to mention the people involved.
Yeah. The history for Viva the Nom mm-hmm. is when I got to Austin, I guess the second time around 1998, 99 about, I met Kieran in film school, and I already made these types of movies, and I showed him like the Star Wars thing we'd done, and he thought that was funny, and we started talking about like doing something else like that, and I'd already, I had some idea for doing like a war thing. And we talked about that, and Kieran's kind of like a military-minded type guy, too. So we started thinking that way, and Vietnam kind of made sense. And to be honest, it was a little bit of a ripoff of the idea in, if you've ever seen Meet the Feebles by Peter Jackson.
Okay, yeah.
They have that scene where, like, this Muppet has Nam flashbacks.
Yeah. Okay.
And we thought that was funny shit, and I was all up on Peter Jackson, and this is pre-Lord of the Rings Peter Jackson, where he's, right. like, this respectable Steven Spielberg type now. Back then, he was, like, he was still the Dead Alive guy, mm-hmm. and the Meet the Feebles guy, and the Bad Taste guy. And I was big on him, I was big on John Waters and all those kind of, you know, because I was like a, you know, 20-year-old film guy, and I was all like, yeah, fuck you, you know. So I was kind of drawn towards those guys. And so we thought, like, okay, let's make a Nam movie like that. And so Kieran's pretty much my partner, like, the whole way from there on out. You know, like, I sort of had the Viva brand of film spoofery, but everything with Viva the Nam, like, Kieran was, like, a partner all the way. And, you know, it's kind of like the Coen brothers, where, like, there's kind of a nebulous thing of who does what, you know? But it basically broke down to, I was the final word on, like, kind of creative decisions. But it was definitely, like, a partnership, and that's why we credit it as, like, co-creators. Mm-hmm. And Kieran is more, like, the indispensable guy on, like, the technical stuff. And he totally figured out, like, how to, like, get something that looked like respectable cinematography happening and that kind of thing on such a no budget and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, like when you look at the stuff I did before working with Kieran and the stuff after, it's just like, whoa, you know, okay. Night and day yeah. difference. People wouldn't be paying attention to this if it wasn't for, like, Kieran's part of it.
Yeah, I have to admit, yeah. it does have a very cinematic look to it. I mean,
yeah, thanks.
And it's funny, too, because you, as a viewer, just someone who cares about the production of things mm-hmm. While you're watching it, wondering what the real scale yeah. of some of this stuff was, because yeah. the scales were often very accurate from, mm-hmm. you know, toy character to toy truck or what have right. you. There wasn't this awkward trying to fit a Hulk into a Batmobile.
Right,
a thing. And even the aircraft were, you know, felt very... equal.
Yeah, and that's all, like, you know, just editing and forced perspective and mm-hmm. that kind of stuff, because obviously we don't have, like, an F4 Phantom that's to the scale of
right,
our figures, but you shoot it in the right way and people buy it. And mm-hmm. and in a way it kind of helped that we had one of our hindrances was we shot everything with a very dated Canon Scupic? Yeah, it's a Scupic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a Canon Scupic we shot everything on, which was a 16 millimeter camera that was literally rescued from a garbage heap, It was about to be thrown out, and we saved it.
So, well, two things there. I mean, one, why? What? I would think that the natural inclination would be to make it, but not to make it feature length. Like, hey, if we're just having fun,
right.
Let's make it 10 minutes.
Yeah, and that's kind of what it started out as.
Oh, okay.
And it ran. I tend to do projects that run away and become big epic things, and this was a case of okay, well, it's just going to be a dopey spoof of non-movies. It's like, okay, we'll spoof Apocalypse Now. We'll have, like, the scene where the tiger jumps out and someone yells fucking tiger and that kind of stuff. And okay, you know. And we were kind of being dumb kids, just wanting to make a non-movie. And then I really set... And we actually started shooting stuff with that version in mind, where it's like 10, 15 minutes or something. And then I actually started sitting down and researching it. And that became like a black hole of expanding the project, where I just read more and more amazing shit about Vietnam. And it went from being like a really superficial thing that was spoofing non-movies, and it turned into like an actual satire of the real war.
I was going to say, that was one of the things that I thought was interesting, was sometimes it's a Vietnam movie, and sometimes it's a Vietnam movie.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And did you... I'm sure you noticed that as it was evolving. Did you mind, or did you go, well, we need to make it one thing?
I think it's okay for it to be two things, because... I think if it was just about the war and we didn't get into spoofing Platoon and Apocalypse Now and that kind of stuff, I think, for one thing, I think people would be watching it and making those jokes themselves. Okay. They'd be saying, I love the smell of napalm in the morning or whatever. Mm-hmm. So there's that. And you don't want to have people get their Mystery Science, their opportunity to do the Mystery Science Theater version. So I think you kind of got to address that stuff. Because, I mean, it's a spoof, and that's... The perceptions of the war are as fair game as the war itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Because, again, this is going to sound like pretentious, like Marshall McLuhan-type film school shit, but, like, you know, it's all that the media is, the medium is the message, and it was the war fought on TV, and all that stuff kind of figures into the attitudes about the war, and why it went the way it did, because... You know, people at home lost morale for it, and that's part of why it turned into, like, a bad war, as people called it.
Finding out that your trade now is being a comic book writer, but you did this film. You sort of mentioned a little bit why you like making the film and how you had done some of the stuff before, but what would you say your background was? Because you also mentioned film school. What are the sort of things that came together to, I guess, make you who you were when you were making the movie and make you who you are now?
I mean, I was kind of like a comic geek mostly growing up, and in my teens I got more into film. Because I kind of realized that's kind of where... I think in an ideal universe I'd be making big budget movies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a thing you're not supposed to say as a comic book person. You're not supposed to say, like, oh, it's a second best medium. It's not. But it's not the first... Yeah, I think if... comic people were being honest, most of them would like to be directing movies, you know, writing and directing movies of their stories, because it's more fun. You can have music, you know. It's hard to do action scenes in comics, you know, that kind of thing, of complexity. You know, you can't do, like, The Killer by John Woo in a comic. You can't show action that's that complex.
Right.
So in some ways, it is a second-best format. But it does have advantages you can't do in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, folks, for anyone hearing the dog in the background there. But anyway.
Sorry.
So I got more interested in film. But at the same time, I kind of realized, like, once I got into film, like, you know, I don't write Reservoir Dogs or Slacker or movies that can be done on a low budget. And so that's why I kind of drifted back to animation, because there you don't have a budget.
Well, and that sort of runs me into the next question I had. When you're watching it, and again, talking about sort of perspective, in the end, you know, with these guys being as big as they were, the jungle around them had to be a certain size.
Yeah.
And some of the time I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, gosh, this was a set. This wasn't laid out on a desk. This was a space that was devoted to, you know, making this an environment around the characters. So how did you do that? Where did you put it? You know, you needed space to do this.
Yeah. I can give you a picture of how big the set was.
Okay.
And what's interesting is it's nowhere, like, the table we shot on is nowhere near as big as people expect.
Okay.
because what we did was we'd build all the set we needed to fit in one shot, and then if we moved on that, you know, so-called set, put it in quotes, we'd rebuild it for the other angle. Or what you saw to the right or the left in another shot was actually, like, the same space redressed, and we moved the buildings around and stuff. And we kind of worked hard to, like, make it so it didn't feel stagey. Because, like, stuff I shot early on really was, like, where, you know, you kind of had three walls, and you didn't move the set around, and the camera was very limited, and we did a lot of stuff to make sure that, like, it didn't feel like the camera was stuck in one place. And, you know, we worked very hard to disguise the artifice by which the movie was made.
Just curious, you know, I watching the movie, wondering, you know, you see these, like, featurettes on, like, an Aardman film, and they sort of talk about, like, well, you know, it's a very complex process, this is what we had to do, each frame was this, and it makes it look like it's one of the most difficult forms of filmmaking out there. I'm just curious, like, you know, how many frames per second did you animate, and if you want to talk about the process of just stop motion animation, I think to some people it looks like a very easy thing to do. I just, you know, go in there and I move this guy's arm and I move it again. And then I think there are other things that make it seem very difficult. What was your experience?
It all depends on what you want to do. You know, like some stuff is ridiculously easy and then other stuff is hard. Like figuring out how to make a helicopter take off in stop motion was really tricky. And we didn't figure it out until like the last year or so that we were doing filming on this.
Okay.
And so like we got... At the end, we're like, oh, wait, we finally figured it out. Okay, quick, get some shots of helicopters going up and down. Because we have plenty of stuff where they're flying across the screen. That's another one that wasn't easy to figure out, because where do you put the strings when you have to have the blade go 360 degrees around? Mm-hmm. And what we realized is, like, the human eye actually doesn't need to see it go around all the way. And so you can just turn it around and actually have two strings hanging down, but people don't, you know, it worked. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like a lot of this stuff, you just kind of learn by doing. Like, the first time, few times we did a helicopter, we actually animated the blades going around completely 360, and we did it this other way. And it's like, actually, it looked wrong when we did that, because the blades were turning too slow. And you can't actually capture that motion quite right, so we just put them in random places. And suddenly it looked like a proper helicopter kind of shot, because the human eye kind of fills in the motion.
Right.
But yeah, but we shot most stuff at two frames.
Okay.
And then for really fast action, like when there's gunplay involved, or when someone's head's getting blown off or something like that, or something's moving really fast, that's one frame.
Yeah, it looked like there was a couple where, I remember one where, and I don't want to talk too much about the movie, but one of the characters, something happens and he gets pretty upset and angry and just sort of goes on a killing spree. There's this shot where it's just him firing his gun and the recoil on the gun, just that animation was very fluid.
Thanks.
And then also, like, I think you had a real helmet at one and it was sort of spinning, and so probably that was a little bit different, but...
I'm pretty sure we did one frame. Yeah, what he's talking about is there's this scene where something that guys actually did in Vietnam is they wrote on their helmet covers. And because we had to get through this scene where there's a montage and we have to show time passing quickly, we actually, like, have the calendar on the helmet, which is something Vietnam guys did, was they did, like, what was called a short timer's calendar, and it shows your time running out, and you black the calendar out as you go. And I thought it'd just be kind of cool, because, I mean, that wouldn't look good in a close-up of a tiny little 1/6 scale helmet anyways. Let's just get a real helmet cover and ride on it, and you know, it cost about $15, which was worth it for the shot. And I thought that was cool that somewhere we could use one, you know, something that was 1/1 scale, as the G.I. Joe collectors call it. I was like, you mean like real? You know, they call it, no, it's 1/1 scale. Life is 1/1 scale. Just call it real. A real helmet. Yeah.
I just meant, I heard you say in the last year that we were working on it. How long did this take?
So we started it in 1999. We shot pieces of it as school projects. and turn those in. And so...
you were like a freshman in college in 99?
That was like junior, I guess. Okay. Yeah.
So for like 2 years you were...
I had a problematic college career. It took a lot longer than 4 years because I decided to, like, I couldn't come straight to UT.
Mm.
And I had to kind of work up to that and getting into the UT film program. So it took me a while to get down here, and then once I got down, I was like, okay, now I can be in film school.
Okay.
Yeah. But like for the last 2 years of my college career, I was in film school.
Mm-hmm.
And I lost my train of thought.
Talking about how long it took altogether, and so you said, because I mentioned...
The timeline for the film, yeah. So... let's see. It was about like 2 years of shooting stuff in school,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of that actually isn't in the movie because it was when we were just starting out, and so it wasn't very good. Some of those shots are in the movie, like the black and white stuff that you see in the movie is all stuff shot in film school.
Okay.
On I think like actually like 8mm. I think like the little spoiler here. The John Wayne instructional film mm-hmm. is like I think it's 8mm reversal film.
Wow.
And Kieran would know better because he's the guy who's like the real camera nut. But and we kind of liked that because we were already kind of thinking ahead, like at that point that we were going to shoot the rest of the movie on video, and it'd be funny to have this stuff on film for when they're looking at film, and it would be like this scratchy 8mm reversal. And we're like, okay, well that's great. It looks terrible, but that'll make it look like it's from the time, you know. And it looked like a film that was run through this projector like too many times and it'll have scratches on it. We didn't do anything that's something that, like bugs me a little bit, like when you watch like Grindhouse or something and they have like the expensive film fucked up on purpose.
Right.
We did nothing to fuck up that movie for the film. It actually looked like that. All the strings and dirt and shit, because it's a cheap, shitty film.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked exactly like what we wanted it to be, which was like a bad, you know, instructional film that you'd see in a church basement or something. And then once we kind of kept going for the, like, you know, the movie, we're putting so much work into it, let's not shoot it on video, which at the time was, you know, we're talking about like 2000, 2001 here.
Yeah, it was still 8mm cameras where the video 8mm video was still the norm, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Kieran's the guy for technical stuff, but yeah, like, video did not look like it does today.
Right.
And we were like, okay, we're not going to shoot it on that and have it look like something the BBC made in the 1970s or something. And so, we said, okay, we'll do it on film. And that turned it into, like, a whole different project. It's like, okay, now we're really putting some serious expense into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it, I mean, that is... The fact that we chose to shoot on film is 80% of the film's cost.
Yeah, imagine.
Yeah, like that, you know, all the stuff, like people say, like, oh, you must have spent a lot on the toys. Not really, in retrospect, because, like, we eBayed them all back.
Oh, okay.
So, as customs and stuff, and, you know, a figure we bought for $30, we do custom stuff to, and turn around and sell for, like, $60 or
$70. Wow.
So, we actually, we lost money on the toys and stuff, but we basically broke even.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't too bad. But, you know, film was just like this black hole of money.
I was going to ask about that. I mean, you said you started in 99, just to answer that one. You finished in...
So, after school ended, like, you know, for me in 2001, and Kieran was still in, I think, for another year, but we started shooting, and I think it wasn't really until, like, 2003, we said, okay, we're going to make this into a feature,
mm-hmm.
and... then we were basically shooting until 2006. So it was about like 3 years of production on it.
Wow.
Of intense production, like where we're like every weekend getting together kind of thing. But we had to stop in the summer because we shot in a garage and it just got too hot in Texas to shoot in the summer.
I imagine.
And also like even parts of spring got bad because it wasn't a great garage. And mm-hmm. yeah, there was no air conditioning or anything and we get like bugs in there and stuff. And aside from, like, the fact that, like, that's kind of a pain to work with, if you have silverfish running over your characters in the middle of the shot, that's going to screw it up, you know, so. it was an uphill battle. And, so, like, basically 2006, I think we got the last shots, It was mostly like really like 2003, 2004, 2005. We're shooting like 2006. We're getting the last few pickups,
mm-hmm.
and then it became a long process of getting it edited from like a lot of footage.
Yeah,
about like I think it was like 3 hours of footage and editing that down, or it might not be. No, it might be. No, actually, as I think about it, no, it's probably not three. That's three. 3 hours would be counting like all the stuff that we took and turned into the because there's also a featurette.
Mm-hmm.
Called War American Style, which is the prequel. So if you include that, it's about 3 hours. But it was just a very time-consuming process editing that stuff into something, you know. And also, to be honest, since we were kind of goof-offs when we started this,
uh-huh.
we didn't quite know what we were doing right away when we started shooting. And so after the fact, I wrote a script.
Yeah.
We had, like, something kind of written out, like, that was more like a treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, oh, we'll think of the dialogue and stuff. And he'll say something like this. It'll take about 3 seconds, you know. And we did something for that where we got, like, covered for those shows. We weren't completely nuts. And so, like, we had coverage of, like, people having talking heads and stuff that you can loop backwards and forwards forever. Mm-hmm. And so we knew, like, we could stretch out dialogue if we needed to and that kind of thing. But, yeah, and a lot of time we're making dialogue up on the spot and then shooting it. And then we'd write that down on, like, a note sheet.
Yeah.
And so, like, okay, here's what we said here and here's what we did here. And then we get it back and, like, you know, you have to voice it over that.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't do any voice work or anything until 2006, 2007-ish. And so then we started the process of, like, doing the voice work, and that took about a year to do. Because it was us, but it was also, like, trying to get other people to do voices, because we couldn't do them all.
Yeah, I thought the drill sergeant was very, just... very well cast. I don't know who it was. But...
that's me, actually.
Oh, really?
Bullshit! Sound off like you got a pair! You know, that's me. You know, I don't think anyone would have looked at this the way they did before Team America came out. And, you know, people with, like, influence, like, you know, Matt and Trey
right.
would say, hey, you know, we're going to make something that's like a spoof of, like, Gerry Anderson shows from the 60s.
Right.
And that's something people will actually look at if you make it nerdy and funny enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they broke some ground there. I think we'd be maybe even more sidelined if not for Team America.
Okay.
And I think aside from the fact that they're using something like toys, they didn't really endanger us so much.
Right.
Robot Chicken is more questionable, but I don't know. I don't think that would ever been made without like guys like Seth Green behind it.
Right, a name so, that you can...
yeah, you know, and that was really the problem with, like, after this premiered, you know, after Viva the Non premiered at the Alma Draft House, and Ain't It Cool News and the Austin Chronicle and some other folks gave us, like, these very nice write-ups, but especially because of the Ain't It Cool News,
mm-hmm.
and thank you, Massa Worm and Ain't It Cool News for writing us up, because that did a lot for us.
Yeah.
He wrote up a very positive, you know, not a complete piece of Ain't It Cool News dick suckery, but he did... you know, like where Harry says, you know, this made my balls explode with greatness, or this kind of hyperbole he can do.
Right.
But the guy who writes for the Massworm did just a very nice, even-handed thing where he said that it's not perfect. You know, these guys obviously were working on the budget
mm-hmm.
and stuff, but, and he was even fair about, like, you know, like where he said, like, you know, the story sometimes runs into trouble. But now I'll say, I think we did very well with what we could do. And also, like, part of that was, like, you know, we didn't know what we were doing, so we had to, like, rescue the movie somewhat.
Okay.
And as we got later into the film, and also in the editing, and, like, we actually had, like, problems with, like, the second act. The early part mm-hmm. of the second act had problems. And it was really most about, like, how to cut that out as much as we could and make it work. And that's why there was kind of like, a lot of montages
right.
in the early second act. When he first gets to Vietnam, it's like, we just, like, you know what, this stuff isn't good anymore.
Mm.
It's just spoofery and it's not interesting. We need to get over it.
Any cool news? And
but yeah, so they wrote up a nice review, and because of that, I got contacted by people out in L.A.
Wow, okay.
And because it never went anywhere, I won't say the name of the company, but
right.
But some folks out there contacted me who were managers, agents, whatever, and we actually got talking to Hollywood people. And one of the things they threw out in the air at one point was, do you want to talk to the people who do Robot Chicken? And it was kind of weird, like, here's our sellout moment, you know?
Right.
And because honestly, I mean, Robot Chicken's fine. I think they kind of go for the easy joke.
Okay.
You know? And I I think they could kind of do more at times. I think the humor can be a bit obvious. That's not to say it's not funny. I've definitely laughed at Robot Chicken. Mm-hmm. But I think they can do more with some things. And I just think it'd be smarter sometimes. Mm-hmm. And but like I said, you know, sometimes you want the fart jokes too. And so that was kind of like a weird moment where they said, like, do you want to talk to the Robot Chicken guys? But I was like, yeah, of course. You know, like, that's not long I thought about that. Yeah, so there's my integrity. But but then that that never but I thought, like, okay, I could work on, you know, I could be an animator on the show or a writer for the show, and mm-hmm. I will bring what I think they should do, you know, like, you know, okay, let's do, you know, the G.I., you know, like the G.I. Joe Cobra skit, but let's take it up a notch.
Right.
Or, you know, like the trans, you know, I remember like one thing they did once where it was just like, really, you know, like, can't you take it farther? Like where they had like Optimus Prime having like bowel cancer or something. And it was like, okay, well, is that the end of the joke? You know, take it a step further. You know, like, okay, he has bowel cancer, you know, like, just saying Optimus Prime has bowel cancer isn't the joke. You gotta go farther.
Almost taking it more into like a full on sketch.
Yeah. Yeah, like there's a guy actually going on like a weird, I don't even know if this, some people would consider this animation. Mm-hmm. There's a great guy on YouTube called Dr. Smoove.
Okay.
And Dr. Smoove takes Transformers and G.I. Joe cartoons and re-edits them and puts new voice work on them. And okay. It's Dr. Dr. period S-M-O-O-V, and folks look it up because it's incredible.
Is this not like the? Is it the PSAs? The old GI Joe?
It's
PSA?
Like those. I don't think he's the guy that did those.
Okay,
but it's very much in that style.
Okay,
and his stuff is really long and involved.
Okay.
Where it'll be like a day in the life of Shockwave on Cybertron, and like Shockwave being useless and having like issues about like how Megatron left him there, and you know, it's good kind of like Venture Brothers kind of humor.
Okay.
Where like Shockwave's a failure and he has to like look in the mirror and confront that kind of shit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more like what I'd like to see them do.
Yeah.
Really. Is like really get in like giving them more personality than they had in the cartoon and then doing a joke out of that. But anyway, yeah. So, but there was a point on the table where I was like, oh, maybe we're going to talk to the Robot Chicken guys, and that mm-hmm. didn't happen for some reason. They couldn't. That's why I don't use the name of the guys I worked with,
right.
Because I kind of felt like they promised they couldn't deliver. They made a lot of promises and, like, couldn't deliver.
Yeah.
They got me into one meeting I wanted to get into. And it was obviously, like, because I wasn't a name.
Right.
They just weren't really listening. And it was like, okay, well, this is a waste of time then, because I wanted to pitch, in addition to doing film stuff, I wanted to pitch some comics.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and, like, the guy told me right away, like, just give me a log line. Which you could tell that these were LA people first,
right.
And comics people second. They're asking for a log line.
Yeah.
It's like, it's been a while since I've been producing class in film school. What's a log line again? You know, one sentence explanation. Well, I can't give you the characters in one sentence, but
right.
Okay, here's the pitch. And the guy's like, oh, no. Superheroes, no.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, but it's like the V with the non version of superheroes, man.
Right.
Yeah, but. Anyways, the other thing we looked at for a while with the Hollywood chapter of View of the Nom was I actually, and I'll say this person's name because he was cool. I actually talked one day to Scott Mosier, the guy who produces Kevin Smith's stuff.
Yeah,
and that was a cool. He saw the movie, he dug it, and we had this cool kind. And it was a kind of LA conversation where he's in his car driving, you know,
right.
Just talking to me between my two other. But he was a really nice guy, and we had kind of ideas about to do something with it. And the main problem with Viva the Nom being a movie that could be put in Hollywood is I think like the production values are kind of for a Hollywood thing
mm-hmm.
are pretty rough.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, we have out-of-focus shots and stuff. You know, you'd have to reshoot shit. I think more likely you sell it to Hollywood and then you reshoot it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which I'd be fine with doing, you know. Yeah, I know how to shoot this thing cheap. I shot the one that we made for the cost of, like, you know, a bad used car. So, you know, give me $100,000. No, give me $60,000. I can make something that would look amazing. Amazing, fucking amazing. And then we get some celebrity voice, it'd be great. Yeah. I actually know a couple celebrities that have seen the movie and liked it, so we could probably get them. You know, like I hear supposedly like from one of my friends who worked for Mike Judge for a while, and he apparently saw like the prequel and said, "Oh, that was actually pretty cool."
Yeah,
it's like, well, hey, butthead, you know, like how's some voice work? You know, he probably wouldn't do that now though.
Yeah.
I also know like this is kind of like a crazy random thing. The actor Nicky Catt. If you know who he is, Austin-based actor, but he's been in like Hollywood stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, saw our stuff once at a party in Austin, and he's some kind of like crazy animation freak, and he was just dying over it. So it's like, dude, let's get Nicky Catt doing a voice, you know, people like that. But Scott Mosier said, you know, that and he was writing this like the main part of the movie is because of the way we shot it. You have to go through some copyright, you know,
mm-hmm.
hoops, which obviously can be surmounted because the robot chicken people do it.
Right.
And it's just a question of who to talk to. And basically it was like before we could really get anything rolling, we had to get a lawyer to look at the movie and evaluate like how much it would cost probably to get clearances
mm-hmm.
for everything that was in and whatnot. So he was actually talking about like using the movie we shot.
Wow. Okay.
So yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you reshoot it and go that way. But so it was talked about, and it was just a matter of like getting the lawyer. And I guess no one believed in the movie enough to put up the money for it.
Hmm. To
get a lawyer to figure out how much it would cost to get the movie, you know, cleared.
Mm-hmm.
That was what no one really wanted to put the money up. No one wanted to take that risk. And I sort of get it because it's a niche film. It's never going to be something released in a multiplex or anything.
Right.
It's an Alma Draft House kind of thing. And, you know, maybe you could hope to make $2 million off this movie one day after video. Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not really enough to start going down the road of pouring money into lawyers and stuff. So I think that's kind of what deep-sixed the Hollywood version of the movie, where we'd actually have Arlie Ermey doing the voice of Arlie Ermey
right.
and that kind of stuff. Wouldn't that have been amazing? But, yeah, so that was kind of like the Hollywood misadventure for Viva the Nom. But there was a brief period for a few months where we thought, like, wow, Scott Mosier's going to, like, freaking produce this. But the reason I do bring up his name is if by some incredible fucking chance he ever listened to this podcast... Here's my message in a bottle moment.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, like, contact me through the podcast, because we never finished our conversation. He actually said he was up for doing it himself.
Yeah.
And because I kind of fell out with the managing group, I don't have contact info for him.
Well, there you go, so, Scott.
Yeah.
Help a guy out.
Yeah, dude. Anyway, but no, maybe at the same time he was being polite, was actually like, I don't actually want to do this. Doing like a Hollywood... tactical withdrawal, which I understand. So, either way, it's cool. I like Scott Mosier. He was a nice guy on the phone anyway. Yeah. It was fun to talk to.
One of the questions I wanted to ask, something that I wondered when watching the film, thought about in a couple of different places. You know, I think some of the things we talk about are a little more traditional, typically. Principles of animation.
Yeah.
You know, did you study these beforehand? Did you know them? Did you research them before starting? Any, you know, what did you do to prepare yourself to be an animator? Or did you have to?
Very little.
Okay.
You know, a lot of stuff I discovered as we were making it.
Okay.
And I'd pick up a book on, like, Ray Harryhausen or somebody. And that would be, like, really, like, whoa, Ray Harryhausen had the same problem. that's kind of, oh, okay, you know, Like Ray Harryhausen talked somewhere in an interview about, you know, Ray Harryhausen.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Just making sure. I assume that's taken for granted on an animation podcast.
Yeah, I think we can assume that most of our audience knows.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you don't know who it is, a lot of the what I guess you would call sword and sandal movies of like the 60s through the 80s.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people have seen the original Clash of the Titans.
Yeah, most people know Clash of the Titans.
Anytime you see, you know, a man in, you know, something pre-digital age fighting a skeleton who's carrying a sword and a shield, it might have been, if it wasn't Ray Harryhausen, it was someone doing Ray Harryhausen.
Yeah. If it wasn't Ray Harryhausen, it was some hack trying to be him.
Yeah.
You know, but just amazing stop motion animation. I mean, he's got to be like the god of stop motion animation. I can't think of any one person.
And just to in Monsters, right. Inc., the Pixar film, they go to a restaurant called Harryhausen's, yeah. Which is a
that makes sense.
Yeah. But yeah. So he had a problem.
Yeah, yeah. I remember reading like how when he was doing the Hydra for what was it, one of the Sinbad movies or mm-hmm. something. He or Jason the Argonauts, one of those. He had this thing where like he had the Hydra heads, and the phone would ring, and he'd forget which head was doing what.
Oh wow!
And it's like so Greg Van Harris, yeah, that's the problem we have when we're animating like 30 Marines in one shot, mm-hmm. and you forget like who was running which direction or something.
Oh wow!
Fortunately, that stuff usually works out. Like when you're dealing with that much stuff, people aren't going to notice like the one thing going wrong mm-hmm. all of a sudden. But yeah, like there's just a lot of stuff we learned in the movie. Like you had to learn by doing.
Okay.
And like one thing is, if you watch, folks listening to this, the scenes in the base camp around the middle of the movie where we see them kind of like in their downtime between going out on patrol and stuff. Those were some of the first scenes we shot. Look at those really carefully, and you'll see just like we have like you know boxes of. You know, stuff just, you know, and oil drums and everything stacked everywhere. We have, like, flags kind of, like, hanging over windows and stuff. And you'll see, like, that stuff's moving sometimes. And it's just because, like, we hadn't the wisdom at that point for shooting this stuff. And we didn't know, like, anything you don't want to move, you better nail down. And so, like, anything that we didn't have moving in the scene, we'd take hot glue and glue it down to make sure that, like, when we're moving our hands around, like, it didn't get nudged. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't always fix that, but you just do your best to minimize it. But it's really bad in some of those scenes. And I think there's a shot, which I can't remember if it's... I actually can't remember at the moment if it's actually made it into the... I think it did make it into the final movie. Hmm. Is there's a bit in one of the base camp scenes where there's this one guy in the background, and not as much in the background as he should be for this kind of business. And he has a... like a do-rag on,
okay.
And the do-rag inexplicably starts moving on his head. Like, it starts, like, kind of, like, rotating. And I remember, and that was one, like, I think Kieran, yeah, not to throw him under the bus, but I think Kieran was animating that. But Kieran did something really funny where he caught that while he was doing it. So he had the guy's hand go up and, like, kind of, like, adjust it. And so, like, we at least called attention to, like, the goof.
Right.
In this weird way. And we do stuff like that sometimes, where something went wrong in the middle of a shot, and we'd, like compensate. Like, there's a bit where this one guy's laughing during... there's a scene where they're all... You'll see it in where they're it's night, and they're all drinking out in the jungle the night mm-hmm. for a big battle. And this one guy laughs. The guy who looks like Teddy Roosevelt laughs. And is like... and, like, falls off his chair inexplicably. Mm-hmm. It looks like he's just drunk and collapsed. It's realized, like, no, he actually fell over in the middle of the laugh. Like, okay, well, let's go with that. You know, yeah. He's drunk off his ass and falls over for no reason. That'll be funny. And there's a lot of stuff like that where something went wrong in the middle of the shot and you had to, like, either compensate or you had to, like, okay, this is where we cut.
So, okay, so then going on that, you come out of making your first one now being someone who knows how to make one.
Mm-hmm.
Is there potentially an urge to make another one, and it would be faster, it would be perhaps higher quality, you know, all these mm-hmm. things.
I'd totally do it if we could get the money together.
Okay.
But it's a question of, in some ways that's kind of like the bitch of it, is like, we got done, it's like, okay, I'm going to go do comic stories.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what's lighting my fire, and none of those stories would work as a stop-motion thing.
Okay.
They're not right for it. It's just the wrong kind of... I don't think you can do a more serious story in stop-motion. I'm not discouraging anyone out there to try it, but I think in this day and age, people don't take that medium seriously enough for it not to have some kind of... It's either got to be something cutesy or it's got to be something ironic and funny. I don't think you can do like a thing where you want characters to be kind of sympathetic and taken in earnest.
Right.
I don't think people will do that with stop motion. And most stories I want to do right now are more in that realm. And absolutely. So I don't think they work that way. But it's not off the table. Okay. For stuff. There are a few stores I have like could work in that mode, but I'd try comics first. But if I had a good idea to do something, I would totally do it again, because I know that's kind of like the bitch. It's like, I know how to make a great stop motion film now.
If whatever you had to budget for the last one, yeah. I imagine this time you could do it for a portion less, you know, money.
Yeah, well, and because now, like, a huge, huge difference is we wouldn't shoot on film, because actually video cameras are good enough now. You can get an image that looks good. So, that's a huge part of the hardship of shooting the movie, was, you know, we'd get back film that was useless, which, there's nothing more heartbreaking than that, but, like, we lost about 2 reels of the movie. Some of that stuff was just never reshot. We're like, okay, that's not important enough to reshoot.
Yeah.
And so there were scenes that went out, and there were some scenes we couldn't take out, but we also couldn't reshoot them because the sets were gone by that point, that kind of thing. We usually tried to hang on to a set, but we couldn't stop every time we were waiting for film to turn, because the way we did it, it took a couple weeks to get film back. And so, there were some things that we just had to, like, cut, and things where we had to keep it, and it looked bad. One thing you'll see in the movie is there are some shots around the end where we're in this tiger cage with a French prisoner. People will know what this is once they've seen it. And the stuff shot, we had stuff shot in that period of shooting that came back blurry. And there's this one shot where, and it's a crucial shot, we couldn't cut it, where this dead body falls out of a plane and lands next to the cage. And I think that gag doesn't work as well as it should in the movie, and part of the reason is because, like, the first shot where we introduced the joke is blurry. So it really tripped us up, but we have to use that shot we have because it's a running gag, and we couldn't...
Right.
And it even plays in, like, the death of a supporting character in the movie, so... we couldn't cut it out. And, so that was a real bummer when stuff came back like that. And I think we had another thing, like, where the film actually got, and again, not to throw him under the bus, because he did great work, but, like, you know, sometimes accidents happen, and I think Kieran loaded one reel of film backwards. Keep in mind, this is, like, a kid who was a film student and, like, 20 or something, you know.
Oh, yeah.
He's much more confident now.
And I imagine that camera was... You rescued it, so there was no manual, and you guys had it figured out as you were going.
He had to... Here's something for the technical people. Kieran had to shoot the movie with no light meter.
Okay.
He had a... Like, there are two types of light meters, like a spot meter, and there's the other kind. I can't think which one is the good kind, which one's the bad kind. We had the bad kind. And he was having to use, like, a very crappy substitute for a light meter. And, the movie, for the most part, looks great, you know.
Yeah.
And, but there was one case where just unfortunate, you know, like, a reel got loaded backwards. And, the good news is it was one of the early reels, so it wouldn't have been that great anyways. But it came back, you know, useless. It looked like it was shot in hell. Like, it was, like, red and orange. Just because, like, the color exposure was wrong. I kind of wanted to use a little bit of that footage for, like, some kind of, like, freak-out moment or something, but it wouldn't have worked. So, yeah. But no, we could shoot something a lot cheaper now.
Yeah.
And, that's kind of a shame, because I feel like we learned all this secret knowledge about how to shoot this kind of movie.
Yeah. Yeah, like, it's unique knowledge. You're not going to find until you do it. So almost the lesson is, you know, if you want to learn how to make a stop-motion animation movie, you make a stop-motion animation movie.
That's pretty much it. It's like you pretty much... I had made a few before this one. It was just because, we did this one that was really epic. And we had to do so many different things in the movie, because it's a very epic movie.
Yeah.
That you keep finding different problems. Like... You know, some stuff is always like, hey, make a person walk.
Right.
When you can see them in full view, and you'll notice we never really do it. Except for a few times. There is a case where you see Colonel Carnage run up some stairs. And that really took some thought, how to do that. And I'll tell you something else, folks, for like, here's an animation lesson, is if you can't do something when you're shooting it one way, do it in another way where you can shoot it and in another shot, and then when you intercut them, people don't see the thing you're not doing.
Okay.
Like, you can't make people walk around much in stop motion animation with dolls, you know, where you see them in full view.
Right.
But if you see their feet working, you know, walking in one shot, and then you see the rest of them in another shot,
mm-hmm.
people aren't kind of worried about, like, you're not making their feet move anymore.
They fill in the blanks?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's kind of like what we did with Colonel Carnage. There's a scene, like, where he's walking upstairs. Like there's two scenes where he walks upstairs. One where he does do it in full view, and that was really hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another one where you see his boots going up, and they're like clang, 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 clang mm-hmm. on these stairs. And, you know, we're just holding him off camera. And then we, you know, take our hand away and pan up, and the hand's not there, because, you know, like, we could do something in the same shot and then take it out because it's animation.
Right.
And I'll give you another example. This is where all the time we would have, like, a limited number of uniforms
mm-hmm.
and a lot more figures than we had uniforms, and so we'd have a panning shot, and we'd have the uniforms on this one group of figures, and we'd pan the camera over, and as we panned, we'd be taking stuff off the, you know, the right side wow. and putting it onto the left side and redressing it. And we do the same thing. That was, like, the most complex application of it. But, like, if you watch War American Style, the prequel, there's this shot of a bunch of Russian soldiers
mm-hmm.
Towards the end of the movie. It's a long panning shot of, like, what looks like 30 Russian, you know, maybe 50 Russian soldiers. We had about 12 uniforms, and everything else was kind of bullshit. And we did it, like, in a pan. And there's another scene in a World War I trench where we see a whole bunch of German soldiers attacking World War I soldiers, you know, British World War I soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And we're panning down the trench in this long shot, and really we only had, like, 6 uniforms between all of them.
Wow.
And we're just redressing it so it looks like 30 guys in a fight. And that's something you can only do in animation. Well, I think nowadays Hollywood has that thing like where you twin people in mass shots and
yeah.
stuff. They do that now, which is kind of similar. But yeah, but you know, people don't detect that you're doing it, and that's really cool. Or like an obvious one is like you drive the same truck through a shot over and over again.
Yeah.
And like in Viva the Nom, you'll see all these truck convoys. There was one truck.
Wow.
But yeah, see, that's a surprise, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You think back at all the truck convoys, and it's like, no, there's one truck, and then what we would do is we'd put like a Jeep between them,
mm-hmm.
and then as soon as the truck's out in one thing, we have the thing coming in. But since we had something between it, people aren't kind of like, oh, it's the same thing going through, because
right.
we kind of keep it mixed up. And we also kept redressing the truck to look different.
What about the helicopters and the airplanes? Just since you're mentioning it now,
We did have a lot of heli. There was no way of not having a lot of Hueys, because I mean, we still did
it's
like
just
reuse
the staple
them a
of
lot.
Vietnam is, you know,
yeah, yeah, you got to have lots of Hueys. There's a shot where we're really getting into the Apocalypse Now spoofery.
Uh-huh.
And in that, you know, like as we're ramping into like the third act battle, and there's this bit where all the helicopters are taking off, we're playing right at the Valkyries and all that. And you see a guy, and it's not like an exact shot from Apocalypse Now, but it's inspired by a shot where you see like a guy with a bugle.
Mm-hmm.
And you see all these fucking helicopters go past him.
Right.
And it's a lot of the same helicopters going past them for that. But again, like, you know, we did have, like, maybe 12 helicopters for that.
Wow. Okay.
But we made it look like it was, like, 50.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah. And in a lot of cases, like, we were putting, like, the same helicopter on the same string through over and over again. But as long as you broke it up right, it worked okay. And then there were some you'd only put through once, just so it didn't look too redundant. Yeah. And the other thing is, like, you know, I think if we only used little models of helicopters, people wouldn't accept those as real.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what we actually did was we had a few helicopters that were full scale, and you're just very careful about where you use them and how,
mm-hmm.
and people accept that the little helicopters are the big helicopters.
Yeah, okay.
And because, like, we have a, it's the smallest helicopter they have in the Army back then, this thing. It was a OH-6 Loach, I think it's called. It's a little scout helicopter, and we actually, someone made that for G.I. Joe's.
Oh, wow.
And so we use that. And, like, when you see in a few scenes of the movie, you'll see like a helicopter in full view. Mm-hmm. That's to scale with the figures. That's the helicopter. That's kind of like a glass bubble front.
Mm-hmm.
And in, I think, two shots in the whole movie, we made that fly. And so you actually see it like fly right over the heads of these characters, and they're shooting at people. And it's like, well, there's the helicopter full scale with the dolls in it. These things fly.
Yeah.
And so people aren't thinking so much about the other shots where they're like, well, that's a little helicopter.
Yeah, okay.
Because we're mixing the scales. And then, like, we'll show the same helicopter, but it's a 1/72nd scale model.
Mm-hmm.
And people kind of follow it like it's the same helicopter. And we also built, like, the cabin for a full-scale Huey, you know, slick. And so we have that, too. But obviously we couldn't build that in full 1/6 scale because that's just freaking huge. But, yeah, I think we did a good job, like, show it here but not there and people buy it. Yeah. Advice I'd give to filmmakers, don't shoot on your own money. That's a big one. If you're going to, you know, shoot on video, first of all. Don't shoot on your own money. If it's over $1,000, just do not do it. I know people who do, and it's just, don't do it. God, don't do it. Second of all is get a script together and storyboard every shot in the movie. We couldn't have actually done that with this, so that's actually kind of bullshit advice. But most people aren't going to try and shoot a feature. But if you're shooting something in 15 minutes, like, have it all worked out very well beforehand. And, you know, leave. If you're doing it like this, you can improvise a bit. But planning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, plan beforehand. And just, you know, always make sure you have, especially with stop-motion animation, and animation in general, have a good story. Have a really good story. Like, something like, I'm not especially like a huge Pixar type guy, mm-hmm. you know, because they're kids' movies, and I think at the end of the day, and I always kind of feel a little bit like a pedophile watching them. But, you know, sorry, folks, for all the Pixar fans out there. But I've actually, my girlfriend's big on them, mm-hmm. and so actually, like, I've started seeing more of them recently. And they're always, like, very, very well thought out stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I said this person, like, they're not even like my kind of stories I get into. I'm more an R-rated kind of guy.
Yeah.
But I gotta say, respect. They get mm-hmm. their stuff down. Like, the first 10 minutes of Up is like some of the tightest storytelling ever. That's a film unto itself, the first 10 yeah. minutes of Up. That tells like a complete three-act story.
Yeah.
And it's amazingly...
Over several decades.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazingly good, efficient storytelling. Wall-E is like brilliant storytelling done visually. There's hardly any dialogue for huge stretches of the movie, which made me like that movie a lot more, actually. So yeah, like, it's, you know, those movies are a big success because there's a good story behind them.
Mm-hmm.
I hear Cars kind of sucks, but that's what I heard. I haven't seen
it. The new one or the sequel? Or, I mean, the old one or the sequel? Or
I kind of heard that, but maybe I was listening to, like, Grumpy Gus's. I don't know, you know? Seems like people didn't talk up Cars the same way they talked up The Incredibles and Toy
yeah,
Story
that
and that kind of stuff.
I've felt that sentiment from the world at large as well.
But for the most part, these Pixar movies are big, and a lot of any animated thing, it's a big success because of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so you gotta, and I sound like Sam Fuller here, you gotta have story, you know, like Tim Robbins, you know Sam Fuller?
I'm
War, kind of war movie cult director kind of guys.
Okay.
One of the guys we watched a lot for Viva the Non. And Sam Fuller was the crustiest old Hollywood kind of badass type guy.
Sounds
and
like a Sam Peckinpah almost.
Totally in like a Sam Peckinpah kind of vibe. He's like a more genteel Sam Peckinpah.
Okay.
yeah. Like the guy that made The Wild Bunch, but not quite so bloody. Yeah. Most people, if they've seen anything of his, they've seen a Lee Marvin movie called The Big Red One that he did, which actually has Mark Hamill in it.
That's
wow. I was like, well, Mark Hamill in a war movie, what the fuck?
Yeah, I knew he did Star Wars and Corvette Summer. And
yeah. It's like the one other good thing Mark Hamill made besides Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Yeah.
hey, kids, it's Cockknocker. But anyways. Yeah, but Sam Fuller, like, does this interview. He did this interview before he died with Tim Robbins. Tim Robbins made a big documentary about him. I probably said dick because I think of Tim Robbins. I'm like, Hollywood dick. making those long Oscar speeches. But anyways, he made this document. Shit annoys me. play that guy off. But anyway, so he made this documentary about Sam Thor. And now I'm going to get hate from people like Tim Robbins, but anyway, made this documentary about Sam Fuller, and in the documentary, he's interviewing Sam Fuller, and he says, what makes a good movie? And he's like, and Fuller's like, story, you know, what makes a good, you know, every answer to every question was story.
That's completely different.
And so I made a way too long-winded point about this, but the point is, story. Get a really good story that would be good as a not animated thing, as a short story. Without any bells and whistles on. Mm-hmm. Have a good story. Because, especially in animation, the amount of time you put into it is ridiculous. Mm. Not even what we did, which is super insane. Because, like, from beginning to end, this movie took about 10 years, really. By the time it was seen by people, it took 10 years. Which, you know, would I make that same movie today? No way. You know, like, it's kind of weird. Like, when you're, like, you know, getting up on 30... and you're making this movie you dreamed up when you were a crazy 20-something, and just like, this isn't like a movie I'd make anymore, even if I have to finish it. Yeah. So, make a really good story, because you're going to be tethered to it for at least, you know, a year or so, if you're doing animation of any kind of complexity. It takes a long time to do. Yeah. And just, don't put out a mediocre product. Okay. That's the other thing. No one needs to see another okay movie. You
know? That's definitely true.
Yeah. There's too much... And it's not going to do you any favors to do a mediocre movie. Because there's a lot of those out there, and no one's going to notice you for that. Do something amazing. And I would say, in animation, keep it short. I know that's ironic coming from a guy that made a 108-minute movie. But if... You know, boil the idea down to the best parts and make it punchy. When animation gets boring, people are unforgiving. Yeah. And I know that from, like, when I screen early movies. It's just, God, you're in trouble. Because people go to sleep in 30 seconds. Not even. With anime. I mean, look how fast you get bored of, like, you know, like a commercial. You know, people can tune out really quick.
Yeah.
So, clever, fast, punchy, good story. And then animation comes after that, actually. Like, if you've got all... If you're short and it's a good story, they're going to forgive a lot of mistakes.
So. All right, well, y'all heard it here. Any comic book stuff we can look for in the future?
Yeah, actually, I've got my cover for Godzilla Gangsters and Goliaths number 4 is going to be out, like, in 2 weeks, I think, for the week of September 15th, I think.
All right.
That'll be out, and beyond that, I do have some other stuff with Godzilla at IDW that might take a while to materialize, just because I'm like number 4 or 5 artists there, and so it's like when jobs come up, I get them. I do have another thing in line with them, but it might be a while before it comes up. And I actually, I did pitch a few things to IDW recently. We're going to see how that goes. I'm trying to get more... I'm trying to get any writing work there. I'll tell you this. Here's an exclusive, because I think this will never happen now. I wrote a pitch for the actual G.I. Joe official comic.
Oh, wow. Okay.
For IDW, and pitched it to them. And
irony.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I didn't really even know if I should say, like, I'm the Viva the Nom guy. It's not famous.
Is that
going to
help,
now.
Or is that going to hurt?
Like, A, it's not particularly famous, and, like, yeah. B, it's like, I'm not sure if that helps or hurts right. When they look at that, and the official G.I. Joe people say, like, oh, what? You know?
Yeah.
But I did do a pitch for them, which for the moment seems to have gone nowhere, so that's a shame, because it was really good.
Yeah.
It would have been Viva the Nom with G.I. Joes.
Wow.
Real G.I. Joe, you know, official G.I. Joe. And I'm very sad they didn't go for it, but I think I was being a bit too Viva the Nom, iconoclastic. I'm gonna take your toys and blow them up, kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
I was killing Joes off for gags, and yeah, I can see why they probably didn't go for it.
Well, either way, check out the you know everything on YouTube, and yeah. Keep an eye out for his name in the comic book world.
Yeah,
and
thanks.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Thanks a lot.
Great interview, Robert. Your interview skills are amazing.
Once again, thank you.
You guys kind of nerd out a little bit. Now, I did want to say the interview is actually an hour and 45 minutes long, so if you guys want to hear the whole thing, we really had to cut it down, and we did cut out a lot of really funny, good stuff.
Yeah.
It just, you know, for time's sake, we had to cut a lot out. So if you guys are interested in hearing the whole thing, email us, put it on our Facebook, and we might even post it up on the Facebook. Yeah. But let us know if you want to hear the whole thing. There's a lot of really good information.
If we in the future are cutting things for time, we might do this where we put it online. You know, you can request the rest of it.
Because there are some, you know, obviously some edits, I'm sure you guys noticed, where it kind of jumped from one thing to the other, but I think it was, you know, you get a good idea of what he's about and, you know, about the film for sure. The one thing, though, that I want to mention is he said something about he doesn't think stop-motion animation can really tell a serious story. He thinks it's quirky. And I think if he were to watch Mary and Max, it would totally change his mind on that, and it might inspire him to do some of the stories that he thinks are more serious in stop motion, because you can do it in a way that people accept it.
I remember him saying that, and in my head, like, going through, like, the just all the animation that I know, trying to, at that moment, say, well, what about this, to see, you know, what his response was. I wish I'd come up with that example, but...
Well, I mean, as much obscure knowledge as both of you guys know, which it was hard for me to keep up with some of it, you know, he probably hasn't seen a lot of, you know, obscure stop-motion films that aren't necessarily in the mainstream, so...
Well, in a movie that came out almost around the same time, I don't know, maybe a year, one direction or the other... it was, I believe it's French, but it's a stop-motion animated film, feature film, called A Town Called Panic.
Yes.
If you get a chance, also check that one out.
They have some shorts, too, that started off, and then that became the movie. But, I mean, that is a little bit more whimsical and quirky.
Of course, that was not an example of serious.
Okay.
But I think my point is the opposite, that, you know, I think what you'll see the most of is the whimsical and the you know, the funny and the lighthearted with stop motion animation. It's not a medium that people run to tell a serious story, but it can be done. Yeah,
and in fact, there was one at the Ottawa Animation Festival that about two rabbits, and they can't find food, and it's deep. And I'm pretty sure it's one of the ones that won. If you guys want to see who won, go to the Ottawa Animation website and check out the winners. And a lot of them are online. So I think that about wraps it up for this podcast.
I think it does.
The next one is going to be Aaron Ogdenblick. So stay tuned. Oh, and we also got to interview Josh Burton, the creator of the Morpheus rig, who is probably one of the most genuine, nice guys I've ever met.
Yeah.
Has his head on his shoulders and knows exactly what he wants in life, which not a whole lot of people do.
I imagine you have to be a pretty nice guy to develop a rig and then...
Give it out for free.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, I mean, he does have some ulterior motives, which is to, you know, get his name out there. But really, I mean, you could tell what he really wants to do with that is to help people tell stories. And it's a very amiable... altruistic thing for sure.
Well, I guess we'll talk about it next time. But I'm just curious: do you know of any short films that have any work that has used the Morpheus rig? That
oh man, I mean, go on the 11 Second Club, and there's a million.
Yeah,
people are using it. Probably the most used rig, I would imagine, right now.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. Oh, we also wanted to just say sorry that we're going to miss Steve Jobs, I guess is what I want to say.
Oh, yeah.
He did a lot absolutely. For animation, especially with Pixar.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're definitely going to miss him and his vision in terms of seeing the possibilities of animation.
And his hands-off approach in the early days of Pixar.
Absolutely. I mean,
there's
a lot to be said about that.
That let them explore creatively.
Yeah, he understood the value of the artistic direction that they wanted to go. And, you know, who knows? A lot of people think that they're losing that now, but you can definitely see it, especially when they first started. And he had a lot to do with that, and especially funding. Absolutely. So we'll leave you on that sad note.